It's heartening to know that the United Nations, not always able to solve problems here on Earth, has a committee of 107 nations addressing the peaceful use of outer space. The list of issues under its scrutiny is not short. They include space traffic management, space debris mitigation and remediation, small satellite activities, and space resource activities. Chair of the Working Group on Legal Aspects of Space Resource Activities is an Australian lawyer, Stephen Freeland, Emeritus Professor at Bond and Western Sydney Universities. Stephen is not long back from a series of UN meetings in Vienna that considered, amongst other things, his initial draft principles to govern how we handle the rocks we find in outer space. Stephen, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Stephen, with the world unable to agree how to handle the resources of the ocean floors, what are the hopes for agreement on space?
That's a wonderful question. And of course, these are complex issues. But the idea of space has always intrigued everybody. The idea stemming back from the Apollo missions when about 250 kilograms of moon rock were brought back, the idea that the celestial bodies, the moon and other bodies in space, had these resources that could be useful for humanity has always captivated excitement. Space is full of natural resources. Orbits are natural resources. We use them every day. Without them, the world would be literally back in the dark ages. So the idea of utilizing the natural resources of space, be they tangible, material, or orbital, has always intrigued us, and it's something that humanity has strived to do. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, of course, depends on your perspective. But it's a forward progression, and humanity wants to see how far it can go in this and other endeavors in space.
There's always, I suppose, been this notion that there may be treasure out there that we have no idea of, that there are rocks and minerals and perhaps gases that might transform our lives. But how real is the expectation of bringing them back here?
I think that's the absolute question, because in more recent times, and I mean in the last 15 to 20 years, companies have lobbied governments, starting in the United States and then elsewhere, saying there are, as you say, these riches. There are, let's call them rare minerals. Mm. There's apparently helium-3, this isotope that combined with fusion technology could create clean energy. There are other materials. And the argument was from these companies that, exactly as you say, we're going to go there, let us say, to the moon. To the extent we mine off Earth, we're not mining on Earth, so that has environmental positive consequences for us on Earth, and we're going to mine and bring it back. The only issue with that, besides all of the incredible technical challenges, is there is no economic case that can in any way justify doing that. The costs of going to, let us say, the moon, which is the closest of these celestial bodies, and then performing whatever activities and then coming back, the costs are so much more when compared to the value that is perceived that it's impossible. And so the whole argument has changed now to say no longer are we going to go there, mine or whatever the word is, and bring back, but we're going to go, let us say, to the moon and then perhaps elsewhere, and we're going to extract maybe not so much the helium-3 or the minerals, but now the water and the water ice, and use that to create an ecosystem off Earth to support life, to support settlements, if that's the right word. But also with water, apparently you can process it into fuel. So in a sense, when we talk about the moon, to create this ecosystem where the moon becomes a refueling station for further deep space activities. And so the whole argument has changed about resources, at least in the short to medium to longish term, because we're not going to be bringing these things back in any material way.
We're going to use them out there rather than...
We're going to use them out there. And that changes the argument because one could argue that if we bring back, let us say, helium-3, and we've managed to...
Stephen, what is helium-3?
I'm not the right person, but it's an isotope of helium that occurs apparently naturally on the moon, not so much on Earth. And because of its peculiar properties...
It's useful.
It's very useful if we can master fusion technology and use it for the creation of energy.
So somewhere behind this notion of using the resources out there are dreams of colonising space, are they not?
Well, that's a word that I would absolutely disagree with, and it's contrary to everything that is the underpinning of the principles about what space is, notwithstanding what certain individuals might say. It's more... The discussion about resources is many things, but of course it's about geopolitics and it's about perceptions of power and perceptions of being the first and the biggest and the best and the cleverest. It's perceptions of perhaps economic gain. It's perceptions of, you know, working in alliances together. And of course, it's also perceptions about maybe helping humanity, but that's one of many perceptions. But colonization, well, it's a word that raises the hackles in the back of, you know, the hairs on the back of my neck.
Well, it's a horrible word, but isn't that what Musk is talking about? You know, that he's going to have some kind of last redoubt for the human race on Mars?
That is what he's talking about, but we are easily seduced by some of these people. Obviously, the technology that the private sector has created for space has... you know, marvellous and wonderful in the sense that it allows us to do many, many more things than we otherwise could. But that's a long way from saying that the private sector is going to dictate the future of humanity. And indeed, in the world that I work in, the names of these people just don't come up. They don't come up at all in the UN discussions. They might be in the background in terms of references to the private sector, but really the big issues of space, and there are many big issues, are still to be decided by the community of countries.
This is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Stephen Freeland about the principles that might govern the exploitation of space. Now, Stephen, what are those principles?
Well, the idea, so I'm, as you very kindly mentioned, a chair of a working group, which is the 107 countries, to determine how we move forward based on already agreed foundational principles of a series of treaties, but we need more specifics. How we move forward in this idea that we might be exploiting these natural resources.
Yes.
And so there are clear principles that are important. Without meaning to sound too dramatic, if you look at the history of humanity on Earth, you know, the vast majority of conflicts and wars that we've had have revolved around the notion of resources, either resources themselves or the areas where resources might be. And so all of a sudden, if we're now talking about resources in an area of space, and space from a legal perspective is a common area that we all have a stake in, if we have to be very, very careful that whatever activities take place promote peaceful activities, promote sustainable activities, promote safe activities, are in accordance with foundational international law. So at a high level, the principles that I've had the privilege of doing the first draft and now to be negotiated by the countries really set out what you would expect to see in terms of promoting cooperation, consultation, working together. But of course, we are operating in a highly sensitive area, a highly competitive area, a highly geopolitical area. And so my role is to bring countries from completely different perspectives together to find a consensus idea. So where they all agree on the basic rules of the road so that they can then get on with it, even if they compete, operating under the same set of rules. The biggest disaster, David, would be that, you know, down the track we have different groups of countries operating, let us say, in a relatively small geographic area on the moon where these concentrations of water ice might be, and operating in their mind's eye under different rules. If they were doing that, that is the recipe for misunderstandings, miscalculations, and worse. And so even if they're not going to necessarily work together, they need to operate under a common set of rules. And I think they all understand that, notwithstanding the incredibly challenging geopolitical times we're in, we're still able to move forward. We've still got a long way to go, but we're still able to move forward on this idea that if we have a common set of rules, then that will allow us to get on with it and we'll try to be better and bigger and faster than you, but at least there's a element of understanding about how others will react in certain circumstances.
But Stephen, what are the fundamental common rules that you would like to see in place?
So, peaceful, that these activities are peaceful, that these activities are safe, that these activities take into account many, many environmental concerns, that these activities are the benefits of these activities are to be shared in some equitable way around the world, that these activities take into account ethical and indigenous and cultural perspectives, that these activities promote cooperation, that these activities promote the idea that information is shared amongst. These all sound like very high-level principles, but high-level principles are what we need at the moment because the reality is we are a long, long way from this actually happening technically, and therefore to set these foundational principles and then subsequently, as we begin to understand what these activities will actually look like, what sort of things will people be looking to do, we can add the specifics, but you need to understand that you have this foundational framework around which every activity must follow.
It sounds to me, look, I know I'm an old grump, but it sounds to me that you're trying to reverse the ordinary expectations of the human race going back to the beginnings of time, which is, if you mount an expedition and you invest in it, you pay for it, and you go out there and you discover something, it's yours. And the notion of then sharing it with people who haven't mounted an expedition, who haven't paid for an expedition, is just utopian. I can't imagine the United States of America having found, say, a mystery new mineral on, you know, a distant planet that is going to transform life on the planet, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, sharing it with China, Russia, Hungary, Spain. How can you expect that? It's very UN, but is it rational?
This is, of course, the question that many people ask. But if you go back right to the beginning of space and then the regulation of space, so, you know, following 1957, the Sputnik 1 launch, and then a series of understandings amongst protagonists in the Cold War, but yet they formed this idea that no country can appropriate space, you can't claim it to be your own, that the notion of space is based on cooperation and consultation. Now, we all understand the reality. Of course, it flies in the face of the way we perceive territory on Earth. But space is different, I would argue. From a legal perspective, it's different. From an ethical perspective, it's different. And here's the real rub to this. We are all dependent on space. I always say that every person on the planet is touched by space. You and I, David, and everybody listening to this has used space today 30 times.
There's something in space that tells me how to get to Burwood.
Absolutely. But there's something in space that allows you to travel, manage your crops, look at the weather forecast, watch television. It keeps the lights on. Every aspect of our society is determined by space. Every country is the same, obviously to slightly different degrees, but every country is dependent on space. We have major challenges already because of some of the other issues you mentioned, debris, the environment, the competitiveness, sadly also perceptions of military uses of space, all of those things are major challenges. But here's the rub. If we get it wrong, everybody suffers. And it's different in a sense from the other great challenge we have in the world, climate change. So with climate change, if we get it wrong, everybody suffers. Australia suffers, you know, everybody here. But who suffers the most in climate change? It'll be the poorer countries, the low-lying islands, etc. If we get it wrong in space, given that every country in the world is dependent on it, who will suffer? We will all suffer, but who will suffer the most? It'll be the major countries because they have the greatest capabilities in space, the greatest infrastructure in space, but therefore the greatest dependency and the greatest vulnerability. And if we get it wrong, if space becomes unsustainable because of, you know, competitiveness becoming something worse, then all of those major countries will not be able to utilize space to their competitive advantage in the way they have in the past. And it, in a sense, will bring them all down and the lights go out everywhere. So there is a powerful undertone to find this balance, this equilibrium between geopolitics and I want to be the biggest and the best and the brightest, myself and my like-minded. But also, if I go too far, if I cross red lines, if I don't necessarily play the game, then in the end, we all will suffer. And I know many people think, well, that's not going to happen. The United States can do whatever it wants. Russia can do whatever it wants. The difference now is that whereas before there were really one major space power, now that space is a multipolar ecosystem. The Americans still have major capabilities, but so do the Chinese, and so do the Russians, and so do the Indians, and so do the Japanese. And so it's not as if one country or even one small group of countries can dominate now. Mm. And so we just have to find that equilibrium.
Stephen, that seems to me to be an unanswerable, rational argument. Okay. You've just come back from a series of meetings in Vienna. How are the countries getting down to work and working together to approach an understanding like that? I mean, is it all sunlight in Vienna?
So they have a draft that sets these high-level principles, and this is a public document that's on the UN website. Of course, various countries will push their particular way of seeing what these rules should look like. And so we have a group of countries under what's known as the Artemis Accords, Australia is involved in that, that have a particular perception about lunar activities.
Yep.
We have another group of countries primarily led by China with Russia, and there are groups of countries and organisations that are looking to set up what's called the International Lunar Research Station, ILRS. They have their own perceptions. We have a whole range of other countries. We have Australia, which is a party to all of the space treaties, including one that already talks about space resources. They will want to protect their rights. So we have a whole range of different perspectives, let alone all of the cultural and indigenous and industry and civil society ideas that are filtered through the countries into these discussions. So the debates are tough, but it's about words. But what I've found, because my initial draft was based on 3 years of inputs from all of these countries, it's not as if I made it up myself. What I found is, at this high level, they all agree it's better to have rules about safety.
Sure.
It's better. And so we are, the discussion is about words. It's not necessarily about concepts, at least at that high level. And so we're actually, notwithstanding the way the world is, all of the countries are curious, and I think at this point engaged, to see how far we can go to reach an agreement. We have until 2027 to reach that agreement.
You're drafting law.
We're drafting rules that have to stand the time, not for 1 or 2 or 5 years, but for 30 or 40 or 50 years. Sure, we might add to it as we develop more and more technology, but these are the foundational notions that move forward. So, of course, it's tough, but, you know, one has to be cautiously optimistic. Anything can happen, but otherwise I wouldn't do it, you know.
Cautious optimism drives a number of trades. Stephen, you've said several times, words, words, meanings of words. What languages will these principles end up in? How many languages?
There are six official UN languages.
They'll all have to, for those six languages.
So we have Chinese, Arabic, Russian, French, Spanish and English. Every document, including my initial draft, is translated into those six languages. Of course, that in itself causes complexities because languages are never perfect.
Of course,
And so, but by and large, I mean, through the history of multilateral organisations, you know, these documents are translated in these various languages, and we find a way. They're not perfectly in alignment, but they are as much as possible. But they're all of equal status.
Yeah. The lawyer's arguments around translations. But now, look, let me imagine the scene. There are representatives of 107 countries gathered in some abandoned palace in Vienna. And in that room are representatives of Ukraine and Russia, Israel and Iran, nations at war with one another. How do they get on?
Well, this is the point where I've learnt that countries are not necessarily entirely rational in what they say, and that points of order and comments and statements that are made are driven not just by the narrow issues of space, you know, that we're talking in the room, but about everything else. So you mentioned a few. Let me throw in also Greece and Turkey, who have major disputes, to the point where one will say the sky is blue and perhaps the other will say, well, that's not true.
Or worse, Stephen, one will say the sky is blue and the other will say the sky is blue and mean something completely different.
That's true. And of course, words can have different interpretations. So, yes, there is a lot of tension in the room. There are a lot of statements in the room. And you mentioned some countries. There are many other countries that have differences with each other. And yet, and this is hard for some people to perceive because there is this idea that the UN is cumbersome and it never works. And, of course, there are many problems with this process. But at least I've found that we continue to move forward notwithstanding. But, of course, the tensions make it harder. I mean, getting consensus in a world of where consensus is impossible on large issues is a real challenge. But as I said, my role is to make it clear to states that it's in their interest to allow this to progress forward, notwithstanding everything else. And, of course, that's hard. But this is an issue where I think they understand that, in the end, they're better off having some rules, whatever they look like, than allowing, you know, the Iran-US situation or the Israel situation or Ukraine and Russia, allowing that to get in the way. We don't know, though. I mean, countries change their policies all the time. We don't know, for example, if the US will have a different view next year than it does this year. But at the moment, they're all very supportive.
Is there an Is there a problem on Earth that would not be solved if we had a few rules? And you want to bring rules to space. Now, I commend you enormously for this effort, and we'll keep a close eye on it on Late Night Live. Stephen, thank you for joining us on the show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, David.
I've been talking to Stephen Freeland, an Australian space lawyer who chairs the Working Group on Legal Aspects of Space Resource Activities at the United Nations. This is Late Night Live.